one of the greatest New Yorkers you never heard of.
So there's this sort of fascinating way in which, you know, this guy who ended up creating Central Park and the New York Public Library was sort of creating the New York that he wanted to find when he arrived at the age of 15, but did not find.
That's Jonathan Lee. We talk with him about his historical novel, The Great Mistake. It's about the man who's called the father of Greater New York, Andrew Haswell Green. Then Michael Mechanic takes us on a tour into the lives of the super rich and what their astronomic wealth says about America. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice, in-depth conversation with writers of all genres, on the air since 2004. Thanks for joining us this hour on this station and at writersvoice.net. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Central Park, the Metropolitan Museum of Art, the American Museum of Natural History, and the New York Public Library, all of these great public institutions were the inspiration of one man, Andrew Haswell Green. Oh, and he was also responsible for the borough system that makes up Greater New York, Manhattan, Queens, Staten Island, Brooklyn, and the Bronx. So how come so few people have ever heard of him? Did it have something to do with the horror and absurdity of his end? He was murdered in 1903 by someone who thought he was actually someone else. A great mistake. And that's the title of Jonathan Lee's novel about Andrew Green. Lee immerses the reader in the character of Green, a fictional imagining that fascinates both with the strangeness and the familiarity of this remarkable historical person. Jonathan Lee is the author of three previous novels. Jonathan Lee, welcome to Writer's Voice. The Great Mistake is about Andrew Haswell Green, who's someone I actually never heard of. He's considered the father of Greater New York. How did you find out about him, and why did you want to write a novel about his life?
Well, I was walking in Central Park about 10 years ago, and I happened to come across a stone memorial bench, and it was overlooking Fort Fish, that section of the park. I just walked past the Alaska skate rink, and I came across this stone bench in a shady, kind of quiet part of the park. And I read the inscription, and it said it was dedicated to Andrew Haswell Green, the father of Greater New York, the creating genius of Central Park. Born in 1820, died in 1903. And I just got really curious. I thought, like, who was this person? Why hadn't I ever heard of him? You're not alone. I've come across barely anyone who's heard of him. And when I started to look into his life, I found that he was this champion of public space in New York City, that he was this real 19th century civic leader who had ended up being murdered on Park Avenue at the age of 83, kind of after creating everything we associate with modern New York. Without him, there'd be no Central Park, no Metropolitan Museum of Art, no New York Public Library, maybe no merger of Manhattan with Brooklyn into a single city. So I got pretty fascinated, but it started with that walk in the park and coming across that bench.
Yes, and he was murdered by a black man, Cornelius Williams. And it was a case of mistaken identity. I guess we can say that right up at the front. It was a great mistake. What happened? And why did Williams go after him?
It was a very sort of basic mistake in some ways, but they got on the surface of it. Williams was looking for another Andrew Green, and he had looked up the name Green in the city directory, which was the equivalent of kind of the phone book, basically, in 1903 in New York. And he had his eyes had alighted on this particular name and this address on Park Avenue where this particular Andrew Haswell Green lived. And what was in Cornelius Williams' head, as far as we know, is that he felt he had been wronged by a woman he'd fallen in love with named Bessie Davis, who also has a lot of aliases and is a fascinating character we could talk about a bit. But he believed that she had left him partly because of something that a Mr. Green had said to her. And this misunderstanding, this kind of great mistake, led to Andrew Haswell Green being shot on his doorstep in broad daylight on Friday, November 13th, 1903. And there are signs too in the record, although, you know, much of this has to be speculation at this point, especially around Cornelius Williams beyond his trial. But it was decided that he may have been insane by whatever the standards of the time could have been. And he had complained about hearing voices and things like that. And then, as is the case perhaps now too, to some extent, he didn't really get the help that he needed.
And why don't we talk a little bit about Bessie Davis? She was quite the character. She, a.k.a. Hannah Elias, she was hugely successful, also Black as well as was Cornelius Williams. Tell us about her and how you approached her in the book.
Yeah, I mean, one of the things I was looking at in this book, The Great Mistake, is the way in which history pushes to the margins people who don't conform. And to some extent, that's Green. And to an even greater extent, that is obviously people of color like Cornelius Williams, the man who shot Green, and also Bessie Davis, who is said to have become the wealthiest Black woman in New York, but who really had to accept some tremendous mistreatment from the most powerful elements of white society in order to get there. She's not perhaps doing what she dreamed of doing as a little girl. She ends up being a kind of high profile prostitute to the rich and famous old white male New Yorkers, including a couple of senators and some other powerful people. But she's sort of doing what she's able to do within the confines of what society is going to allow her at that time in 1903. And she kind of brings her resourcefulness to bear upon everything she does. So she ends up living in this big mansion and being supposedly the wealthiest Black woman in New York. And as you say, her alias was Hannah Elias. She had multiple names. When you look into her history, she was this Black woman who came up from nothing. And she had served some time in a prison for, like, when she was like 15 or 16, I think it was. She worked as a maid for a white family, and it was said that she borrowed a dress for a special occasion. She wanted to wear something nice, and they treated that as a theft, and she ended up serving some time in prison. And when she came out, she sort of started this climb towards being what she called the premier satisfier of the needs of gentlemen of the higher sort in New York City.
Yeah, she's an amazing character. So the book, The Great Mistake, begins with Andrew Haswell Green's murder, as I said before. And then it moves back and forth between his life from his early years and, in fact, ends quite in advance of his death. But tell us about his early life. He started out as a farm boy in Worcester, Massachusetts. Tell us about his life and his family, and how did he get to New York?
Yeah, so he had this sort of fascinating upbringing in a way. He was, as you say, he was from a big farming family. They had some money at one time and then were falling on hard times around the time that he was growing up as a boy, one of, I think it was 8 siblings. And he was sent away effectively to New York City from Worcester, Massachusetts at the age of 15. To make some money and be useful. And the only job he could get was as an apprentice boy at a general store called Hinsdale and Aitkins in an area that's now the Lower East Side, but like at the time was really just the city of New York, you know, because everything was squished down in the bottom of Manhattan Island. And he worked there for a while, and he really wanted to educate himself because he hadn't had the luxury effectively of going to school much. He was needed on his parents' farm, and then he was sent away to work, as I mentioned. And he sort of searched the city for two things, really, like places to educate himself, like libraries, but he found that he couldn't really afford the fees necessary to become a member of a library, because the entire library system in New York was made of private libraries at that time. And the second thing he wanted to do is indulge his love of the outdoors and get some exercise and stay healthy in the choking smoke of New York City in 1820. And he looked for places to safely walk amongst greenery and found that really the only appropriate places were also closed off to him, were also private pleasure gardens where he couldn't afford the ticket price. So there's this sort of fascinating way in which, you know, this guy who ended up creating Central Park and the New York Public Library was sort of creating the New York that he wanted to find when he arrived at the age of 15, but did not find. And, you know, along the way, it was a time when it was just possible to kind of rise up from nothing to some extent, even though his particular rise was pretty surprising. But he met Samuel Tilden, who was a successful lawyer who would later become the governor of New York and presidential candidate who lost to Rutherford Hayes. And they would kind of pin their star to each other a little bit and help each other out. And Green became a lawyer and then this great creator of public space in the city.
And he became a lawyer in Tilden's practice. You treat their relationship as quite an intimate one. You know, I did a little bit of research online before speaking with you, and nobody mentions quite the intimacy. You know, Tilden is called a mentor. What was the relationship between them, and did you kind of massage that relationship?
Well, it's difficult because there's some element of sort of imagining the interior lives of any character, of course. But there were rumors at the time that they were in a relationship together, something beyond friendship. It actually impacted Tilden's presidential chances. It was thought the fact that neither of them had ever married, the fact that Tilden had never married, the fact that certain rumors swirled around him. And I was also really lucky when I started researching this book to go to the New York Historical Society Library and meet a fantastic researcher there who was able to bring me boxes of Andrew Haswell Green's diaries and letters that no one had checked out for, I think it was 17 or 18 years. The last person had been someone doing their PhD a couple of decades ago. And, you know, there are sort of diary entries that sort of make, and letters, I guess, that make clear that they were the sort of central relationship of each other's lives, the central emotional event. But it is also true that young gentlemen would correspond with each other in, you know, something more of an intimate way, even if it was platonic, than they might do now. And that sort of led me down the path of this book. Like, it was clear that there were sort of frosty patches in their friendship and relationship. It was clear that there were things that were unsaid. It was clear that these rumors were swirling around them, and that particularly affected the friendship from Tilden's point of view. But it sort of led me in the book to, I suppose, to hedge my bets somewhat in that, I think that they were the central emotional event of each other's lives, but you won't see a sex scene. You won't see me sort of imagining my way too far down that path. But when Tilden did die and Green was named an executor of his will, I think it sort of, it crushed him, because he never married. He didn't have any children. Like, Tilden was kind of the closest person who ever came to be with him in a way.
Yes, and, you know, there's been a lot of speculation about Abraham Lincoln being bisexual. And, you know, with the interpretation that other people point out is that relationships between men were far more intimate in the 19th century than would be allowable in our, you know, notions of masculinity or of straight masculinity today.
Yeah, and I think it's, you know, I don't label their friendship or relationship in the book. And I wonder the usefulness of sort of applying modern day labels to these things. And in some sense, there's an element of guesswork involved, although it's certainly true that it was extremely unusual for men in fairly high public office to live to their 80s and not marry at any point at that time. But there's only so far we can get with speculation.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Jonathan Lee about his novel, The Great Mistake. It's about the great 19th century figure in New York, Andrew Haswell Green, the father of Greater New York. Now, a real turning point came in his life when he went to Trinidad. Why did he go to Trinidad? And what happened there that was such a turning point? And I guess I wanted to ask you also, what did you find in the research that you used in this part of the book?
I didn't find that much about his time in Trinidad, except for these facts, that he went there when he went in around 1840. A financial crisis had hit New York, and his work as an apprentice boy and then working for a cloth merchant had kind of dried up. And he went back home for a while. He had a period of sickness where he feared that he might die. Sounds like a particularly bad bout of influenza, perhaps through the modern day lens, but we don't know. And then he met someone who was a sort of family friend in Worcester, Massachusetts, on a visit back to his siblings there, who suggested that there was perhaps an opening at a sugar plantation in Trinidad. And Green had never even heard of Trinidad, but he eventually accepted this position. He got baptized just before he went, because there was a suggestion that while he was over there, he might set up a Sunday school for workers on the plantation. And so he went over there, and he had what we can glean from letters and little notes here and there was a fairly unhappy time, and set up this Sunday school where it's originally seemed like a success, and then less and less students turned up each day. And there was a suggestion of some kind of scandal sort of requiring him to leave within a year from Trinidad. But I was very lucky to find some other research materials, like including a diary of someone who was there at the same time on the same plantation. And that's where a lot of the sort of color and texture around that Trinidad section came about. And I started to think about writing that section in a different way too. You know, I feel like often what's talked about in terms of a novel is like an evenness of tone, as if that's something to aspire to. And for me, I sort of in this book, I wanted to have some sense of play and some sense that like each section of the book would decide its own style. And so that section of the book almost came out a bit more like a poem, I guess, you know, this constant refrain of what he's lost and what he's found. And I think it was a big turning point in his life. And when he came back, he sort of remade back to New York. He remade his friendship with Samuel Tilden. And very soon after that, within a year or two, they had joined in this law practice together with Green as a kind of trainee.
And the two of them went after Boss Tweed, went after this incredibly corrupt, you would say a para-government in New York. Talk about Boss Tweed and how Tilden and Green teamed up to clean up the city.
Yeah, that was a real surprise to me. It was about a year into the research, I think, before in the New York Times archive and a few other places, I started to find all these references to Andrew Haswell Green and Samuel Tilden effectively being the people who kind of teamed up to bring Boss Tweed down along with other people. And, you know, as you reference, and as many people will know, he was a kind of American politician with some Trumpian overtones, actually, when you look back through his speeches, who was most notable for being the boss of Tammany Hall, the Democratic Party's political machine that played a big role in the politics of 19th century New York City and New York State. And at the height of his power, he was this sort of, he was perhaps, I think, the third largest landowner in New York, and he directed the Erie Railroad, and he just had his fingers in a lot of different pies. And he was, I think, pretty much in plain sight, really, at a certain point. He was stealing millions and millions of dollars from New York City taxpayers from his political corruption. And no one was really like calling him out on it. The Democrats weren't really calling him out on it. They were fearful that it would boost the Republican party's chances. And the Republicans were sort of, you know, a lot of them seem to be in bed with Tweed too. And when Andrew Haswell Green, in one of the many sort of major roles that he ended up playing in history, when he became the comptroller of the city of New York in charge of the finances, he played a key role in kind of like going through all the ledgers and everything and saying, well, it's interesting that this friend of Tweed's was paid $100,000 to install new seating in Tammany Hall when there is no new seating, and the new seating would have only cost $2,000 in the first place. So all of that stuff eventually led to Tweed being put in jail. And actually, you know, Green playing a major role in turning around the finances of New York City, and actually signing bonds and stuff in his own name, putting his own money at risk just to try and salvage New York from bankruptcy effectively.
And he became the first comptroller of New York, and that was around the creation of Central Park. Talk about the creation of Central Park, you know, working with Frederick Olmsted and I don't remember the name of the other great architect, but this was a phenomenal story because Central Park was not being well managed, the building of it, until Green came in.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, Olmsted and Volks were obviously they were the designers of the Greenwood plan, but actually Green was kind of in there before them in a sense. Like he was in those meetings discussed, he was there campaigning with people like Andrew Downing for a Central Park, for what he was then calling a middle park in New York City. I think he eventually decided that middle had associations with the gastric system, whereas central made you think of the heart, and that was a more useful sort of branding strategy. But he and these others were sort of campaigning that, you know, the state of sanitation, the air quality in New York City, the overcrowding, the sense that the city was sort of missing its heart and lungs effectively, and that it was only going to get worse as the city moved north. And so this huge expanse of land that is now Central Park was sitting there. They thought at first it was unoccupied. You know, it transpired that there were villages like Seneca Village, which was sort of a big black settlement at the time that ended up being displaced for the park. But yeah, they campaigned for the wild land that was basically north of where New York City was at that time to be turned into Central Park. And Andrew Haswell Green became the president of the Park Commission, and Olmsted and Volks sometimes would complain that he nickeled and dimed them, and that he was, and they were also at times more interested in a grand park with sort of entrances named after rich sponsors, rich people in the city. And it was Green, I think, who really wanted the gates of the park to be named after just types of working people, Merchant's Gate, Hunter's Gate, Poet's Gate, even Artist's Gate. And that's what ended up happening. And he managed to steer that through trouble and make the park a reality.
And then there's the whole father of Greater New York, the fact that he's responsible for the development of the borough system. I mean, this just floored me. You know, this is like one of the central features of New York City. I don't know of any other city that has boroughs like New York does. So tell us about that. Why did he want to create a Greater New York? And then there were some regrets ultimately that he had about it.
He did. He actually wasn't necessarily a fan of the borough system that ended up transpiring. He had sort of various reasons for that. But what he did believe in really strongly, kind of before anyone else, as far as we can tell, is consolidating the existing city of New York, which in his lifetime had really just been Manhattan, with Brooklyn, Western Queens County, and Staten Island. And, you know, eventually this section of the Bronx west of the Bronx River had been annexed to the city of New York in 1874 and was known as the Annex District. But he believed in bringing it all together, and he believed that New York's future relied on it. And of course, it's like a lot of people don't living in Brooklyn don't even know now that Brooklyn used to be its own city rather than a borough. And actually, you know, his campaigning work and eventually pushing that through, that gave me my title, you know, before I'd even thought of The Great Mistake as a title in relation to his murder in a case of mistaken identity at the beginning of the book and the detective work that follows. I had read a New York Times article, I think it was, where the headline at the time after the merger went through was The Great Mistake of 1898, which is what the merger was known as for a while. And that was especially led by people of Brooklyn feeling that it was going to be a financial disaster for Brooklyn to merge with the rest of the city. And for a while, actually, it was, in the same way that the Brooklyn Bridge, which Green was also involved with, put a lot of ferry workers out of work and so forth.
You know, I kept on thinking about a comparison between him and Robert Moses, who was the other great master builder of New York City. But he's almost like his opposite in some ways. What are your thoughts on you know, compare and contrast Robert Moses and Andrew Haswell Green?
Yeah, I think the main difference in a way is that Moses was a self-promoter, and his aims were not always great for the people of New York. And I think that with Andrew Haswell Green, there was a sense that he was a very private man, but he believed in doing public good, which doesn't mean that he was perfect all the time by any means. But I think he believed in public space as opposed to private space. I think he believed in free education for all of New Yorkers and did some work towards that end when he was on the city's board of education. He believed in stamping out corruption. And you wouldn't necessarily associate a Robert Moses with any of those things, but I think Moses' superpower of leaving his mark on everything and getting his name out there has sort of led to him being remembered. And of course, there's Robert Caro's incredible book, The Power Broker, that gives it amazing character study of Moses. But with Green, it was like, you know, he wasn't really, I think he probably thought that his name would last, but he didn't do that much to ensure that it would, which I think makes him pretty likable, actually. But it's a kind of sadness that his name has fallen into forgetting somewhat. And it's, you know, it's surprising that mine is one of the first books about him.
And I'm so glad that it is, actually, because, I mean, it's not only a terrific story and novel and beautifully written, but it really introduces the reader to a very important, a very important person in American history and also a very important exemplar of what a true public servant can be.
Yeah, I think you're right.
Well, Jonathan Lee, thank you so much for talking with us here on Writer's Voice about The Great Mistake and about Andrew Haswell Green.
Thanks so much for your generosity and your time.
That was Jonathan Lee. Read an excerpt from The Great Mistake by going to writersvoice.net. Next up, how the super rich really live and how their wealth harms us all. Stay tuned after the break. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. Sign up for the free Writer's Voice podcast and weekly newsletter at writersvoice.net. You can find more great content there, including web-only features like book recommendations and extended interviews. Or you can find the podcast on whatever podcast app you use. The rich are getting much, much richer. In 2018, the three wealthiest men in America held combined fortunes worth more than the total wealth of the poorest half of Americans. And the pandemic has made it all much, much worse. My guest, Michael Mechanic, wanted to know how the super rich deal with all that astronomical wealth. Does it make them happy? Does money make their lives easier or harder? What do they think of us peons so below them? How does it skew their perception of reality? His book, Jackpot, explores these questions and more. It's an inquiry that begs the question, should billionaires even exist? Michael Mechanic is an author and a journalist for Mother Jones magazine. Michael Mechanic, welcome to Writer's Voice.
Thanks so much for having me, Francesca.
You start the book with a quote from Bill Gates. You realize I could spend $3 million a day every day for the next 100 years, and that's if I don't make another dime. And he's not even the richest man in the world. Talk about why you decided to write this book and talk to all these people who have that kind of wealth.
Well, it's funny because in the book, I use a different example where I calculated for Jeff Bezos at the time, what his wealth was at the time, and that was pre-pandemic, that he could pay himself an annual salary of $800,000 for the next 200,000 years, which is how long human beings have been in existence, basically. But I was fascinated with our fascination with the idea of coming into a windfall and how that might free us and eliminate all our problems. And it's a huge thing. Half of American adults play the lottery, and not just poor people, fairly wealthy, upper middle class people play it even more than very poor people. And, you know, my original idea was to look at just lottery winners. And the book would be called Jackpot, and it would be just looking at what happened to families who had won the lottery. Because, you know, you hear the horror stories, right? We all hear that, you know, your life falls into ruin. And yet in fact, the last year we spent $95 billion on lottery tickets. And that's just an insane amount of money. That's, you know, more than the GDPs of most nations. So I wanted to see what this fantasy was all about and what it was like from the other side, from the people who had actually come into vast wealth and how it had affected their lives and what that meant for society, the fact that we fetishize this great wealth.
Most of the book is, the vast majority of the book is not about lottery winners. It's about people who have hit the jackpot because of either their own work, but most often because they had resources to begin with. So let's talk about definitions. Let's start with the 10 percenters, top 10%, versus the 5 percenters. What's the difference?
You know, you can be a millionaire and still not be in the top 10% these days. At the time, the numbers I was using were the most up-to-date that had been like fully vetted, and that was from 2019. And it changed a little bit in the pandemic, but I didn't want to hinge on a pandemic year just because things were so weirdly out of whack. But as it turns out, the very rich did extremely well during the pandemic, a very large increase in the stock market. And of course, we've seen it bounce back, but you know, there was amazing profiteering, especially in sort of billionaire level. Okay, so the 5% means you have basically, in addition to the value of your house, you have an extra $1 million or so sitting around to invest. That's the 5%ers. You have this discretionary income that you can profit from, as opposed to just, you know, a lot of the people who are millionaires, the 10%ers are millionaires because they bought a house in a high growth area. And now that house is worth, you know, $1.5 million or something, but their wealth is still wrapped up in the house. And until they sell it and move somewhere else where they can buy a cheaper house, you know, that it's all locked up. The 5%ers have more free wealth that they can use to, you know, send their kids to private school and put them through college and take fancy vacations and just invest and bring in money on their money.
Now let's go to the difference between the 1% versus the 5%.
Okay, well, the threshold for a 1% household is 5.6 million. There's something like 1.83 million families with that kind of wealth. It's a lot. But the average wealth of the 1% is 26.7 million. And that's because it's so skewed at the upper end. In fact, anytime you take a wealth category and look at the average wealth, and then you look at the high end wealth versus the threshold, the bottom wealth that you need to get into it. It's vastly different. So I mean, you could look at the 1% and divvy it up, and the people at the top of the 1% are, compared to the average 1%er, they're almost as like crazy rich as the 1%er is to the rest of the country.
Okay, so let's go through this because the figures are really stunning.
One of the surprises, I guess, is how out of touch Americans are with the actual level of wealth disparities in our country. We know it's bad. We've always known it's bad, and we became more aware of it after Occupy in 2011 when people started talking about the 1% versus the 99%. That wasn't a thing until 2011. We feel like it's been around forever, but it hasn't. I mean, everyone's all, you know, griped about the zillionaires, right? But we weren't talking about wealth inequality so much then. I mean, the academics were, but the public wasn't. And now it's sort of household language. We talk about the 1%. And, you know, there was a famous experiment by these two professors, Michael Norton and Dan Ariely, where they got like 5,000 Americans and they asked them, well, the first thing they did is they showed them pie charts of wealth distributions. And one was a complete equality. So each 20% of the population had 20% of the wealth. And then one was actually, they didn't tell people this, but it was Sweden's, which was more, you know, it wasn't equal, but it looked a lot different than the US's. And then they showed them the US wealth distribution, which was pretty extreme. And they didn't tell them it was the US, right? They would show them these pie charts and they say, if you were just to be dropped into one of these societies, which would you rather live in? And people looked at Sweden versus perfect equality, and they said, oh, they would take the Sweden wealth distribution because we really don't want perfect equality. It doesn't make sense, right? I mean, there are people who kind of deserve to have more based on what they contribute to society. And that's fine. That's reasonable. But when does it become unreasonable? And so when people looked at Sweden versus the US wealth distribution, like 95% of them chose Sweden. And these are Americans, and it was Democrat or Republican, it didn't matter. They chose Sweden. This is really kind of telling. The second part of the experiment was almost more interesting. They said to people, okay, you know, for each wealth quintile in the United States, what do you think would be a fair distribution of wealth? And then what do you think it actually is? And so at the very high end, they dramatically underestimated the amount of wealth that the top 20% owned, right? And at the bottom, they vastly overestimated. So they said, okay, the bottom 40%, how much do you think they should have? And how much do you think they do have? And people said, well, they should have at least, you know, like 15, 20%, but I bet you they have 9%. And the real number was
0.3%. 0.3%, the bottom 40%.
Yeah. And now it's actually zero. It's nothing. The bottom 40% collectively have no assets at all. And you say, well, how could that possibly be? Well, if you're a 40%er, you have some assets. But if you're in the bottom 20%, you have negative assets. You're in debt.
And we know that something like 40 or maybe even more than 40% of the American public doesn't have the extra, I've seen different figures, $500 or $1,000 to use in the case of an emergency.
Right. And that's a pathetically small amount anyway, if you think about the costs of living. And the other thing they don't have is any retirement savings. I mean, they're completely going to be dependent on Social Security, which is not going to be sufficient for most people. I mean, old age is expensive.
Now, the early chapters outline the, well, not so enviable aspects of hitting the jackpot. It's a lot of work taking care of all that dough.
Yes, it is. And I, you know, I think about, there's sort of a drop off when people talk about their self-reported happiness. Researchers have done this across vast data sets, vast numbers of people. And sort of across the board, when you get up into the range of annual income between $65,000 and $100,000 a year, that's where your sort of self-reported happiness peaks. And it doesn't seem to go up beyond that. Now, you know, they don't really have access to very, very, very high earners because those people don't participate in research at all, right? So they have to extrapolate. But there is this sort of idea that at a certain point, your satisfaction with life starts decreasing with higher wealth, because that wealth puts a lot of burdens on you, and you know, becomes sort of what you think about, and it whispers in your ear, it sits on your shoulder and weighs you down, and creates a lot of options, but also a lot of, you know, vexing choices involving your family and inheritance, and what are you going to do with yourself, actually? Because, you know, you, beyond a certain level of wealth, you actually don't, you don't have to do any particular thing. You're free in a way, but that freedom can be actually very troublesome for a lot of people. They don't know what to do with themselves.
You actually say that extreme wealth bears an odd resemblance to poverty in terms of the psychological malaise it inflicts. And you talk about the difference between intrinsic and extrinsic pursuits as a way into thinking about this issue. Tell us about that.
Well, intrinsic values are sort of like community-mindedness, bonds between friends and people, and helping one another, and these sorts of sort of psychological healthy values. Whereas extrinsic values are things that have to do with how do I look to other people? They have to do with material success and status and job position. And essentially, extrinsic values are materialistic values, to put it simply. And researchers find that people who espouse these sorts of materialistic values have very low quality psychological quality of life. I mean, they have shaky relationships. They tend to be unhappy. They're more prone to sort of antisocial behaviors, you know, drug and alcohol use. There are a lot of sort of negative things that go along with this. They did a study of children, like high school age students, in different eras, where it was, you know, from sometime in the '80s to like 2007, where they saw a big increase in what they call the materialistic values orientation, MVO, of these kids. And they associated that with all sorts of sort of mental health pathologies. When you start chasing success and appearances and so forth, it can be a really, the outcomes can be really ugly for you. People say, well, you can be poor or rich and have a strong materialistic drive, and with the same kinds of results. But the people who have kind of pursued wealth and status all their lives, the people who have achieved that also tend to be people who pursue it. I mean, not always. And once you get into that realm, and you're surrounded by other people with showing off their boats and houses and vacation homes and, you know, connections, it's pretty easy to get wrapped up in that. And that can lead to a lot of feelings of sort of inadequacy.
And envy of those who are above them, even the 0.1%ers who feel poor in comparison to the 0.01%ers.
Yeah, it's a funny thing that this one guy I interviewed named Richard Watts, who's sort of a conciliary, he's a lawyer for these incredibly wealthy people, like some of the wealthiest people in the United States, and he kind of oversees everything for them. He's sort of their right-hand man. He told me before we spoke that he had just come back from Mitt Romney's annual summit, where he has, you know, former presidents and senators and governors and some of the richest people on the planet. And they go in powwow and they talk about, you know, the problems of society from their view and what should be done about it. And one thing I asked him is, did you talk about economic inequality? He said, no, it wasn't on the agenda. And I said, well, that seems to be one of our biggest problems. But they don't think so, apparently. But he said, you know, the average wealth in that room was at least, you know, $500 million a pop. And he said, when you get in that environment, he says, I'm not saying they're all like this in their daily lives, but when you get in that room, everybody is trying to figure out who's got the biggest yacht. And he means that as a metaphor, right? And he said, and the biggest boat is pretty quickly identified. You know, he said, Michael, if you were in that room and somebody said, what do you do? And I said, well, I'm writing a book, whatever. You know, that would be end of conversation. said, if you don't have a string of 20 private equity plays and, you know, this and that, you're just persona non grata in that milieu. He also told me about a billionaire client who was having a big party, and it was limited, you know, a limited number of people he could invite. It was a couple hundred or something. And he basically told this guy, Richard Watts, he said, look, if you don't have a B, meaning you're a billionaire, you're just not going to get an invite, which is kind of crazy, right? That you would segregate yourself socially. I mean, life can become very transactional at that level of wealth, because all of these guys have, you know, they're incredibly busy people with all sorts of moving parts in their lives, and they don't have close friendships. I mean, everybody is always looking to get something from them, and that's how they see the world. You know, you come to them in friendship, they're like, what's in it for you?
This is Writer's Voice, and we're talking with Michael Mechanic about his book, Jackpot, How the Super Rich Really Live and How Their Wealth Harms Us All.
One thing I write about is something called income segregation, and it's essentially wealth flight. It's where researchers have studied the change in urban areas, and so you have a mixed wealth area, and all of the people with means leave that area for wealthier either communities or just areas of the city. And you end up with this sort of shrinking mixing of wealth, which is actually very bad for social mobility, it turns out, because when you decrease the mixing of rich and poor, people don't move up in the world as fast, interestingly. And of course, the poor are stuck in the poor areas, and they can't even live in mixed wealth areas. So, I mean, this has really increased over the past four decades, you know, and it's not like an evil thing necessarily. It's not like, oh, I have money, I'm going to get away from these people. It's all couched in, well, I want to live somewhere where I have more space and the soccer fields are nicer and there's less crime, etc. But it leads to the same thing. And sometimes people do move because wealth becomes awkward in mixed wealth community. They want to be able to kind of show off their wealth and be around people that also have wealth. And so, you know, you can talk about your Aspen house, and that's normal. I call it the bubble, right? And that can be a trap for people, because when you're in the bubble, you forget about the people and their needs in other parts, even other zip codes, or even the town next to you. And you don't see their problems, and you think that the way you live is normal when it's really, really not.
Right. And that then is exacerbated by another factor that you talk about in Jackpot, Michael Mechanic. And that is that the wealthier you get, the more psychologically selfish you get, the less you care about other people, the more in you could almost say sociopathic you become. Talk about some of the research behind that and, you know, what that means for our country.
Well, let me qualify that. Nobody has ever done a real before and after study, because it's just not possible. You can't, you know, get a big sampling of people and then look at them when they become super rich and how it's changed them. I mean, I asked everyone I talked to, do you think money changes people? And the sort of stock response was, well, if you're a jerk, it makes you a bigger jerk. And if you are a great person, it makes you, gives you means to be a wonderful person. You know, that it sort of like amplifies your pre-existing personality or tendencies. But if you look at all the research that's been done on a spectrum of wealth, they look at, And sometimes it's parental wealth, because the students, they're dealing with student volunteers, and they look at their family wealth. You see a marked kind of increase in antisocial behavior, willingness to cheat and steal in sort of very petty ways, and lie if it helps you get ahead, a sort of a entitlement and a the rules don't apply to me kind of thing, which you see very much in among the wealthy, sort of like the expectation that, oh, you know, the rules are for little people. And I think to some degree, the richer you are, the more you tend to think you can kind of get away with things. And we see this with all these people who should really be in jail and are not, because they're powerful. They have giant entourages of lawyers and people to run interference and PR people. It's very hard to prosecute a billionaire. But in much smaller ways, though, you know, just sort of this, you see this across a gradient of wealth. You see like lower income people. If they cheat, it's to help someone else, right? If they steal, it's usually, if, I mean, these are like, they're saying, oh, if I worked at a restaurant, would I basically steal food to give to my friends? Yeah, they would do that, right? But they wouldn't do it for themselves.
Or the rich would do it for themselves.
Yes. There's been so many different types of experiments and setups in real life and then also in laboratory kind of situations. No one of them is going to tell you much, but put all together, they really show a tendency of people on the higher end of the spectrum to engage in these behaviors that most people would associate more with poverty, which is sort of the surprising bit. There's a very funny experiment. There's a couple of them. One has to do with this guy, Paul Piff, who was at UC Berkeley. Now he's at UC Irvine, University of California. And they actually sat at an intersection in Berkeley and, well, a crosswalk, sorry. And they registered the cars going by, kind of make and model, and to see if they would stop for a pedestrian going to the crosswalk. And it turns out people driving more expensive cars were much less likely to stop for a pedestrian. And they were more likely to cut people off at an intersection. So, I mean, these are sort of some funny things. He also did a thing where he, with a flip of a coin, he pitted people in a game of Monopoly, volunteers. And he said, okay, you're the rich player, you're the poor player. And he rigged the game so that the rich player had started with twice as much money. They got to roll two dice instead of one. And they got twice as much when they passed go. And they would watch them play and then kind of talk to them afterwards. So the people who were obviously in a position, a rich position by the flip of a coin, during the game, when they watched them, they would become increasingly more aggressive and would start saying cocky things and sort of actually physically spreading out. They actually had little gradients on the table where you could look at their body position and they were taking up more space. I mean, these are sort of funny little things. And then Piff said to me, the thing that was really interesting is afterward, when they said, asked the people, well, tell us about how you, your strategy in the game. The rich players, instead of saying, well, I obviously just won the coin toss, so I had this giant advantage. Instead, they would talk up all the things they did to, you know, their strategy. And this is how I won and the buying of the properties, you know, they would rationalize as though it were their doing. They downplay their privilege. And the funny thing is the way he rigged that game. In the book, I play Monopoly with Paul Piff. And I say, look, let's do it a little differently. Let's make it the 1% versus the middle class. So, you know, the amount of money we would get and the advantages would be more, you know, realistic in terms of the wealth distribution. And it turns out we couldn't do it because there wasn't enough money in the Monopoly set so that the rich guy could start with enough money.
Well, you know, it's something to chuckle about, but it's not so funny when it comes to how our political system is bought and paid for by these folks. You talk about a study that was done, which I was aware of before reading your book, Jackpot, but I don't know how many people are aware of it. This was a study by political scientist Martin Gillens, a 2005 study where he discovered that on issues where the views of wealthy voters diverged significantly from those of the broader public, the policies ultimately enacted strongly reflected the desires of the wealthy, of the affluent, but bore, quote, virtually no relationship to the preferences of the poor and the middle class. 90% of the American people are in favor of background checks for buying guns, and yet we cannot get a bill through Congress. But take climate change, take the minimum wage, and, you know, take our healthcare system. There just doesn't seem to be any way to move the needle on the kind of legislation that we need. So you broach the idea in the book that we can change this. How?
Well, you know, when I wrote the book, it was a slightly more hopeful time. It was right when things were coming to a head, a new administration coming in as a trifecta. It was the post George Floyd protests. There was a, sort of change was in the air. And I feel like what we've seen is a backlash to a lot of these ideas, a lot of the more progressive ideas to change. And, you know, the Biden administration is actually, and the progressive members of Congress have actually put a lot of language into draft bills that would have a big impact, like killing some of these like crazy loopholes that allow people to completely avoid inheritance taxes. And, you know, obviously there's been an effort to pass new campaign reform legislation, which has gone nowhere. I mean, it's incredibly problematic that we have essentially an aristocracy in America, and it has undue sway over the political process. Because yes, just what you said, it's like, there are so many things that everyday people agree is reasonable, and they just cannot get through those chambers because, frankly, on both sides of the aisle, you have money influencing people, and including, you know, there's a lot of billionaire Democratic donors too. And there's been other studies that find that even among Democrats, the Democratic members of Congress with more wealth are more resistant to supporting bills that would reduce income inequality or wealth inequality. And so that really, even in who these people are, it has an impact.
Well, it's been so interesting talking with you, Michael Mechanic, and really interesting to read this book, Jackpot, How the Super Rich Really Live and How Their Wealth Harms Us All. Thanks so much for joining us here on Writer's Voice.
Thank you, Francesca. And if people want to learn more about the book, they can go to my website, which is called readjackpot.com.
Michael Mechanic is a reporter for Mother Jones Magazine. Go to writersvoice.net to read his post in Mother Jones about why equality in America is so elusive. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. You can also sign up to get the show delivered straight to your inbox or subscribe to the podcast and the newsletter. And follow us on Twitter at Writer's Voice, all one word. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.